Hi, I'm Janice Graham, and I have just published my sixth novel, Red Lily, and I'm very excited about it because I've never written anything like this before.
Janice Graham's new novel, Red Lily, is a story about a man whose quiet life is interrupted when he inherits an estate from an aunt he's never met. A trip of obligation turns into an unexpected journey into the world of espionage as Carl Box discovers that the aunt he never met isn't dead. Inspired by her own black sheep aunt, her inadvertent work for a spy, and the writer Graham Greene, Janice Graham blends espionage with humor in Red Lily. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Janice Graham. So we do our best to keep our interview spoiler-free, especially anything that has to do with spycraft. With that in mind, can you give our listeners a description of Red Lily?
Well, first of all, the time period for Red Lily is really important. It takes place in August of 1989, just when the Cold War is beginning to wind down. And it opens up in Orlando, Florida. Carl Box is a 34-year-old paint and varnish consultant with the Epcot Center in Disney. And he has just gotten a letter from a French lawyer informing him that he's inherited some property in Paris from an aunt he's never met. As a matter of fact, not only has he never met her, he actually thought she was already dead. This aunt was a black sheep in the family. They never spoke about her. And when they did, it was always in very hushed terms. And it usually implied that she had just done something very bad or she was a very bad person. But no one would ever say why. And Carl never asked any questions, and questions were always discouraged. So it was always aggravated by the fact that whenever he misbehaved, he was told, if you're not careful, you'll turn out just like your Aunt Lily. And so, needless to say, he had a very bad opinion of her, even though he'd never met her. So it was rather stunning for him to learn that he had just inherited this property. And in addition to that, I just want to say a bit about Carl's character. He's, like I said, he's early 30s. He's a very mild-mannered man. He's living a quiet life in Florida. His parents are both rather recently deceased. He's an only child. He doesn't have any family, but he's quite content. He's probably a little lonely, but he has no desire to travel. He's very happy in his small world. He thinks, why would I need to travel when I have all the world at my doorstep? In other words, the Epcot Pavilions, the Epcot Center. He's not very adventurous. Travel for him is also problematic because he doesn't want to leave behind his dog, Billy. But this envelope contains a first-class ticket, and Carl is the kind of man that understands his duty and his obligations. He's also a very kind man, and so he feels compelled to go. So he takes Billy with him, and they fly off to Paris. So from the beginning, nothing is as it seems or as he expected it to be. The law office that sent him the letter is closed. He receives an anonymous summons to his aunt's funeral, but then there's no funeral. And when he finally gets entrance into her apartment and starts meeting some of the friends and starts learning a little bit about his aunt, he realizes nothing is like what he had expected to be. He has more questions than answers, like what has happened to her? Was she murdered? Who? Why? What was she up to? And who was she exactly? From that moment on, the story actually, it's like Carl has been dropped into this twisty adventure, like something straight out of a spy novel, which it really turns into a bit of a spy novel. There you have the KGB, you have British intelligence, you have coded messages, you have eccentric operatives. There's a priest that's trying to find his runaway wife. There's a very seductive environmental activist that Carl's falls head over heels for. There's a debonair French detective. And then you have his aunt, who first is dead, and then she's alive, and then she's dead again. It's really a novel of transformation. It's espionage, but it's funny, it's humorous. Carl is transformed by Paris, by romance, and most of all, by this ever-growing bond between himself and his very unconventional Aunt Lily. But it's also a very touching portrait of a woman who risked everything in order to stay true to herself.
So you do a nice job in the opening pages of subtly establishing time, place, the age and gender of our narrator. And our narrator, as you mentioned, is a 30-year-old man living a quiet life in Florida. You are not a 34-year-old man living a quiet life in Florida. Most writers have to get into the minds of their various characters, but this one is told through one point of view throughout. Can you talk about writing from the perspective of a 34-year-old man living a quiet life in Florida?
Yes, that's a great question. Thank you for asking, Beth, because this was great fun for me. I have to point out that several of my novels have had male protagonists. But when I started this story, I knew from the beginning that I wanted to write an espionage novel because I've been fascinated with espionage for quite some time. But I've never been a spy, and most of the people who write these novels are spies or ex-spies. And I thought, well, how do I do this? I'll just have to just wing it and write whatever I can write. And I started rereading my favorite author, Graham Greene, whom I love not only for his espionage, because he didn't write just espionage, but he was a great humanist. And I always start, before I start writing, I always read one of Graham Greene's novels before I start writing. And I started reading Travels with My Aunt. And I thought, wow, this fits perfectly, because I also had a story I wanted to tell, our own family story about a black sheep aunt. And even though Travels with My Aunt, the character, his aunt, isn't exactly a black sheep, she is very unconventional. And I thought, this is a perfect setting. And so I blended together the espionage and this story of telling the revelation of an aunt that reappears in this young man's life and completely changes it. And I just picked up the first person narrative. That's the way Graham Greene told his story in Travels with My Aunt, was with first person narrative. And so I just picked it up and started going with it. And I never asked myself any questions. Can I do this? Can I not write from this point of view? I never even doubted it. It came so naturally. I did have to stop and think along the ways. I thought, when Carl meets Greta, how do I write his attraction to her? You know, I did have to stop and think at some points, what is he going to notice about her? How is he going to feel? But for the most part, the relationship between him and his aunt, I really didn't think too much about it. And it's interesting, because that was the one thing that my editor actually came back and asked me. She said, would you rewrite this from the point of view of a woman? And I said, absolutely not. That would completely change all of the dynamics of the story. And besides, I actually found it great fun to be a man in the story. And I think it's rather hypocritical for women, now that we finally are able to, you know, have so much of the market, that we are told that, oh, you've got to write from the point of view of a woman, and you've got to write a woman's story with just about women, and men are always secondary characters. And, you know, just sort of is contrary to everything that we should be trying to do. In other words, if I want to write as a man, and what has really amazed me is I've seen some reviews come in from men, and no one questions that there hasn't been anyone saying, this doesn't sound like a man writing this. As a matter of fact, when my copy editor read it, he read the first, gosh, he was like a little bit into the novel before he finally wrote in the copy editing notes, I just now realized that this is a man and not a woman. I said, well, how could you miss that? It was in the very first page. He had in his head, because he knew I was a female writer, he had assumed that the voice of the narrator was a female, and it just didn't jive with him. So it was a very interesting experience, not so much the writing of it, which I loved. I loved being a guy. I loved having that freedom and that adventure and being to, you know, being involved in adventures the way a man would be. But it was very interesting to see editorial and publishing responses that didn't even show up in the readers.
That's kind of crazy that your copy editor didn't realize that, because that was one of the things that I noticed. Because there have been stories where I honestly don't know from beginning to end. These are more likely short stories, but from beginning to end, I do not know who is telling the story. I do not know the gender or their name. But here in chapter one, on the first page of chapter one, it says Mr. Carl Box, and later Mimi calls him Monsieur Box. So, I mean, That's what impressed me, was I knew immediately who was telling the story. So
yes, thank you.
You know, I read in your author's note that this novel was inspired in part by a true story. Could you talk about that story?
The action plot itself was actually inspired by the true story of a man named Vasily Matrokhin. Essentially, his job was to keep the archival information about everything the KGB had ever done. And the KGB, although we know that it is massive disinformation, they were meticulous about keeping records and documenting everything. So all of the truth went into their records that were kept in the KGB archives in Lubyanka building in Moscow, and later moved outside of this building, which is when Vasily Matrokhin actually had the opportunity to start copying these things. But for many reasons, he became upset with and very disillusioned with the system early on. And over a period of almost between 10 and 15 years, he systematically hand copied notes, took notes from the files that he then tucked into his shoes and took out with him. And then over the weekends, he would transcribe his notes. He'd take them to this dacha, this country house, and he'd start transcribing all of these notes. And he built up masses of information over the years. He started hiding them first in milk bottles, then he would hide them underneath his dacha. And when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, not long after that, and the borders began to loosen, and he took some papers with him and crossed the border into Finland and approached first the CIA, but the CIA didn't want to take time with him. They had too many other refugees coming out of the Soviet Union to deal with him. So then he went to the British intelligence, and someone there, the receptionist apparently at the embassy, she spoke Russian. She immediately realized what she had on her hands. And so she brought out some of the intelligence people. They interviewed him. They sent him back. A couple of weeks later, he came back with more documents. And then several months later, he came back out with his family. And they sent in British agents who brought out something like 6 trunks full of archives that he had copied over the years. The FBI later described his contribution as the most complete and extensive intelligence ever received from any source. And these files are still now being delved into. As a matter of fact, it was only last year that French intelligence started looking into the files to try to find answers to their own questions as to how many French intelligence were leaking information to the KGB.
You know, this story you're talking about is different than Samizdat, though, isn't it?
The Samizdat is what Lilly was publishing. That's a little bit different from what Matrokhin brought out. Matrokhin brought out these KGB archives, but the Samizdat is the business that Lilly has been in all these years. What she's doing is she's getting Samizdat smuggled out of the Soviet Union and then publish it in the West. And Samizdat is essentially a grassroots creation. There's something that is distributed and censored within the Soviet Union or outside the Soviet Union, but it's always censored and underground material. There's one definition that I'm going to read for you here, because it was a definition that I found that was given by the human rights activist upon whom I based a character in the novel. The character of Maxim is very loosely based on Vladimir Bukovsky. And he describes Samizdat as, "I write it myself, I edit it myself, I censor it myself, I publish it myself, I distribute it myself, and I spend jail time for it myself." And the danger really was in copying and distributing Samizdat to others inside the Soviet Union. Because the thing was that any typewriting material could be traced back to typewriters, because all the typewriters had to be registered with the state. So Lily's job has been all along, she has been taking Samizdat that has been smuggled out of the Soviet Union and publishing it in the West. And that's what Carl discovers when he finally stumbles upon her enterprise.
Is it true that you used to work for a KGB spy unknowingly?
Unknowingly, yes, it is. It's interesting because it wasn't until I started thinking about writing all of the additional material after having finished this novel, I never really questioned where my fascination with espionage came from. But when I started thinking about it, because I've been reading espionage for many, many years, and I started thinking about it, and I realized that's when it started, back in the 1970s. There we go. Now I've sort of revealed my age here. Back in the 1970s, I worked for a man who is quite exceptional, actually. He was an American entrepreneur who negotiated loans between the Soviet Union and Western corporations. Now, back in the 1970s, this was in, there was, they called it the Iron Curtain for a reason, because it was impossible to do business with the Soviet Union. There was no trade. There were no trade organizations. And the only way, if you wanted to do business with the Soviets, was to know personal ministers in the ministries in the Soviet Union. And the man I worked for, I just started to say his name, but I better not say it, although there's actually a Wikipedia page on him, but he was really a fascinating man. And he hired me, interestingly enough, when I met him, I was working as an executive secretary for a financial analyst in the Rothschild Bank in Paris. And I met his secretary, and she said, "We're looking for somebody to take care of our books and our accounting." And I thought, I can do that. You know, I'm okay with math. I'm no accountant, but I'm okay with math. And so they hired me to take care of all of his personal accounts. And it was a very small run business, and there were only a few of them, but he was this bigger than life character. He wore Savile Row suits, and he had a yacht in Saint-Tropez and all that. But he was also a fascinating man. And he, like I said, he negotiated loans between the Soviet Union and Western corporations. And people had to meet him, pay him, and then he would introduce them to the Soviets. My friend and I, who was his secretary, used to joke about the fact that we were working for a spy. We really didn't think we were, but we did. We were sent out to do some of the strangest things. But then he died, supposedly of a heart attack in a hotel room in Paris, which that scene is sort of in the novel. But a lot of it was invented also. It's very interesting because I think he actually spied for everybody. He was not very monogamous. He was a polygamous spy, if such a thing existed. I mean, I think he gave information to the KGB. He gave information to Mossad. He gave information to the CIA. He was just, you know, he was spreading around information just right, left, and center. So he definitely spied, but who he spied for and who killed him, nobody knows.
We talked about the time setting. I mean, this was in 1989, the end of the Cold War. How did that affect your writing? Because, you know, there were cassette tapes and CDs, but no iPhones. Hex codes had been invented, but you were limited on what your characters could do based on the time and place where they were. How does that affect writing as an author?
Well, actually, I found it very liberating because I lived during that time, of course. And so I didn't have to think of technology. I just wrote the story. And it was a very human story. And my first days in Paris date from way back when, oh my goodness, we had to go to the Champs-Élysées and put a token in a phone booth to call the United States. And I remember taking off and traveling through Greece. And my mother only got letters from me like once a month. It was a completely different time period. It was very liberating. So I found it wonderful. I didn't have to think a lot about technology and would this be possible or would it not? And actually, I was just watching a movie the other night with my daughter, and it was quite funny. It was an espionage thriller. And we were sitting there looking at each other with our eyebrows going up thinking, we can't even get the internet in our own apartment to work half the time. And this man just hops from Istanbul to God knows where. And the next day he has all the money he needs. He never has to go to an ATM machine. It's just ludicrous. I mean, yeah, you can, you know, stretch your imagination a little bit, but at a certain point, the unbelievability of it is just ridiculous. So Actually, I found it very liberating. I found it a lot of fun. I didn't have to worry about who was sending what.
You have Wichita roots. I saw a nod to Kansas in the book. Didn't know growing double-flowered peonies was difficult here. You have lived in Paris for many years, which makes it nice to have most of this book set there. What was the Disney attraction for you?
Oh, there is a lot about Disney in there. I think because when I was a little girl, I was fascinated with Cinderella story. I remember getting it on one of those little yellow plastic 45 records. And for the first time we went to Disneyland, I was a little girl and I was just enamored with Sleeping Beauty's castle. And I think maybe that may have been my draw to Paris, which is sort of silly, but I think that's maybe where I fell in love with Paris was through Sleeping Beauty's castle. And those things come up all the way through. And that's very much personal experience, Carl's experience of having this ex Disney experience. But in the story, he is actually from Santa Ana, California, from Orange County. When we meet him, he's already moved to Orlando, Florida, but he was born and raised in Santa Ana, California, and his father had a paint and varnish company, and they had a contract with the original Disney studios. So Carl's story, goes all the way back to Santa Ana. But I also had an aunt who lived in Santa Ana. And so my experience, I remember first when we were little going to visit my aunt and uncle. This was a different aunt, not the black sheep aunt, but a different aunt. And going to visiting Southern California and Disneyland and Disney World, it's always been a magical experience for me. And I think that just came out all the way through the novel. There's a line that Mimi says later on in the book. When he said, "Are you going to miss leaving Disneyland, leaving California, moving back to Paris?" And she says, "I will miss all the happy people." I mentioned this in my notes. I wrote this novel during COVID, and it was such a bleak time. And I really didn't want to write anything bleak with anybody dying. Well, people die in this, but it's not tragic. It's not tragic. I wanted to write something uplifting and fun and lighthearted. And so the Disney theme runs all the way through the novel, that theme of lightheartedness and time for happiness.
Well, the book is Red Lily. Janice Graham, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Beth. It was a pleasure speaking to you again.
Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.